Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam and I will be talking with drowning expert Dr. David Spillman about preventing deaths from drowning. Really important topic this summer, and a very common, sad, but common cause of death for children.
Yeah, and actually even adults, Christy, we're reading about this regularly and we're like, whoa. And then it's like, well, this isn't really new. This has been going on for a long time. And what can we do about it? And his article in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think, is an important one. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation. But first, we actually have some really important also research that matters about exercise and depression.
About gout and obesity.
About cataract surgery and preventing hip fractures. Interesting.
And about hospital food and their salt load.
This is embarrassing, but we're going to share it with you. Let's talk about our very first, though, Research That Matter article, Christy. Research that was in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, looking at the effects of exercise versus medication on depression.
And this is important. We know that people with heart disease are more likely to have depression or at high risk of having depression, and that if they're depressed, they may have, you know, bad effects from their depression and related to their heart disease. So it is significant. Up to 40% of heart patients have symptoms of depression. So this was a study looking at 101 heart patients with depression to see what happens when you do exercise versus medications for depression versus placebo.
Right. And they found that the groups who got the medication, in this case, it was a medicine called an SSRI, and those who had exercise actually did better than the groups that didn't get either, that just got a placebo. And there was really no significant difference between the exercise and the medication. But what I thought was really impressive is that the exercise was just as good, maybe a little better, and it had less side effects.
It was. They do these depression scores that they monitored, and the scores got better by 6.1 points in the Zoloft group or the medication group, but got better by 7.5 points among the exercisers, and then just by 4.5 points in the placebo group. So everybody got a little better, but exercise was at least as good and maybe a little better than medicine. So, I mean, that to me, the people who did exercise were also less tired and had fewer sexual problems than people on the antidepressants. So,
right. And this was actually research done at Duke University. We commend this research. It clearly is not easy to do. And having many of my patients who are elderly and are dealing with depression, even getting those patients to start exercise, but to realize that it can have just as big of an impact potentially as medication, I think is a powerful study. It's going to change what I probably counsel patients.
It is, and it's got other good, wonderful effects on the heart and on the body for these patients who need to be exercising for their heart.
So it's the first step of probably many research that we'll talk about. Let's talk about another research article, Christy, that was about gout. And I guess one thing I didn't realize is really how frequent gout is and the increase rate of gout in the population.
So for our listeners, gout is a painful form of arthritis where you get swollen, red, and hot joints. Sometimes it starts in the big toe, but can affect other joints.
The whole
body.
And
is really painful.
Right. And this was research that was in the journal Arthritis Care and Research, looking at changes in gout over the last 15 to 20 years in the United States and its relationship potentially to obesity.
And they found, looking at this periodic government health survey, that between 1988 and 1994, it was about 2.6% of U.S. adults had gout. So that's about 4.7 million people. And then, but they did it again between 2007 and 2010, and the number had gone up to 3.8% of Americans, which is about 8.1 million adults. And the obese Americans had the highest rates of gout.
Right. 5.5% of those who were moderately obese had gout, and 7% of those who were severely obese. That compares to only 1.5% of those who are normal weight adults. And it suggests that there's a relationship, and we don't really know why, but a relationship, a strong relationship between excess weight and development of gout.
And, you know, we can't say that doing gastric bypass surgery or losing weight is necessarily going to cure somebody's gout, but it might. I mean, this is the beginning of us understanding this better, and we do know there is this relationship with the heavier you are, the more likely you are to have gout.
I think it's the Wizard of Oz, Christy. I know you're looking at me like, what out of where did
that come
from?
I wish y'all could see my face.
I think it's the Yellow Brick Road. And here, the Yellow Brick Road is behavioral change, it's weight loss, it's exercise, it's quitting smoking, and we're starting to find that that Yellow Brick Road really leads to great improvements of health. Let's talk about actually—
I love that, Adam.
Well, thank you. Thank you. The Wizard of Oz is a favorite. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is a different type of road, and it's the road that we don't sometimes think about, which is surgery for one condition, like cataracts, preventing potentially a need for surgery of another condition, like hip fractures.
Now, hip fracture is a really big deal. After a hip fracture, your risk of death goes up dramatically, and a lot of bad things can happen by sort of losing your mobility and surgery and all the different things that happen as a part of that. So preventing hip fractures should be a priority for everyone.
Right. And this research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, we've heard of that journal, haven't we? Looked at Medicare, 1 million people who are on Medicare who are diagnosed with cataracts, 37% had that surgery over a 7-year time period. And that same population, a little less than 1.5% had broke their hip, and a little more than 5% had any type of fracture.
So the bottom line is that the people who had surgery for cataracts to improve their vision were less likely to fracture a hip in the next year compared to those people with cataracts who didn't get the surgery.
And less likely to have any type of fracture, really. And those who had the severe cataracts, the worst type, were actually 23% less likely to have hip fracture. Now, that makes sense. But it's wonderful when the data pans out. Like, this having cataracts is not just about what you can read, how I sometimes think about, mm-hmm. Oh, this helps you read. This is about your whole lifestyle.
Well, and this weighs for me, for people out there who are considering cataract surgery but dragging your feet, to really have this conversation and think about the other benefits to having a crisper vision, which could save your life.
Including less accidents while driving. Mm-hmm. I think there's some pretty good evidence out here. So lots of reasons here to do something positive here that may have a positive benefits on both fronts. Speaking of maybe things that aren't so good, though, our last research that matters. I'm kind of embarrassed, Christy.
Well,
should we say anything about it?
My only excuse is that it's from Canada. But it is a study
about— so it doesn't apply to
exactly
the United States.
We know that's not true. Okay, so hospital food, even though we have lots of sick patients and lots of heart patients who should be on healthy diets, the researchers found in investigating food in hospitals that 4 in 5 patients who are not on a sodium-restricted diet and just ordered regular hospital meals exceeded the Institute of Medicine's maximum amount of salt per day significantly.
Right. So the recommendation is a little over 2 grams of salt per day. And of these 2,000 patient orders at 3 hospitals in Ontario, they were getting an average of 3 grams of sodium per day. And even among the diabetic patients, it was even higher, 3.5 grams a day. Oh, my goodness.
I think the take-home point is a couple things. One is, if you're a patient in the hospital or your loved one's in the hospital, think about what you're ordering on that list and ask how much salt is in there. Ask your providers, should you be on a low-salt diet? And think about the nutrition. But for us, from a system standpoint, Adam,
think about
that's
how much
embarrassing.
Salt is on the diet. Yes, as a provider. Well, you know, Christy, it should be probably in our guidelines. I don't know if the diet is part of, like, you know, we still have be able to choose versus part of the order sets that we give that automatically.
Well, and we still have to choose, but I wonder if it's true.
That we may need to be more automatic about this. Mm-hmm. That we have systems to prevent this from occurring. Help us, and we will work on our own quality assurance issues as well.
And hospitals should be the place where people get fresh, delicious food that makes them want to then go out and change the way they're cooking.
Without 3 grams of salt.
That's right.
Well, that'll conclude our Research That Matters, Christy. But in addition to fixing our hospital food, we're also talking about cataract surgery, maybe lowering hip fractures.
Talking about gout risk going up as your weight goes up.
And exercise has a potent medication to help depressed patients. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with drowning expert Dr. David Spillman about preventing deaths from drowning. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Age. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Spillman about preventing death from drowning. We read about Dr. Spillman's work in the New England Journal of Medicine, where he had an important article recently about drowning. And he works with lifeguards at the Drowning Resuscitation Center, a pre-hospital emergency facility developed to deal with water-type emergencies at the Rio de Janeiro beaches in Brazil. And we want to welcome you, Dr. Spillman, to Your Health.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Spillman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Well, it's
and talk about prevention and drowning, so ever.
Well, we're glad that you're willing to be with us. We would love to hear how you became an expert in drowning. How did this particular issue become so important to you?
Yeah. Since I was a little kid, I loved to go to the beach, and I loved to surf and swimming. And when I became a doctor, I started to look for some kind of work that I can do near this facility, these pleasures. And it was a little hard to find, but at the end, I find that the fire department has a little space just in front of the beach in Rio de Janeiro that deal special with the drowning. So I start to work with them as a military. I'm actually a colonel of the fire department. It's a military force. And I start to work with them. And when I get there at 90, there was very little information on drowning. And I start to write some letters. At that time, you need to write a letter, and you have maybe 2 or 3 months until you get back the answer. It's not as fast as we have now in the internet. And I start to look for people that care for drowning, and I found International Life Saving Federation. And I start to make contact with a guy in the south of U.S. in Florida. His name is one of the authors of this article. And we start to exchange information with the U.S., Australia, Europe, and we start to get things much more clear on drowning.
Well, we want to thank you for that passion, because as we are still in the summer months, I'm struck every day every week by reading about young adults and older adults and younger children that die from drowning. And you think about when your article, you talk about immediately that drowning is a leading cause of death worldwide among young boys and people of between ages of 1 and 4. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's really surprising to people.
Yeah, the problem with drowning is that something that happens, a disease, a trauma that happens in a pre-hospital setting. And this, it's a little bit difficult to gather the information about this and to see a hospital who has the experience on dealing with drowning. Because in pre-hospital attendance, each of attendants goes to different hospitals. So it was really a surprise to me when I first gathered the information how many people die by drowning. And you see, if you get on the World Health Organization and ask them, what about the people who is dying by drowning? They know very little about that, and that's why, and that's because countries has many difficulties in reporting the amount of drowning of each one has. So. U.S. do very well, Brazil do very well, almost all countries in Europe do very well, but the other countries in the world does know very little about how many people die. And this is mostly important on children from 1 to 4 years of age. And they drown in the little ponds and around the house and pools and a very small amounts of water.
And it's so striking to know that in the United States, drowning is the second leading cause of injury-related death in children 1 to 4 years of age. So, I mean, even in our country, we may be doing a better job of reporting it. But it's a significant public health problem, and I see how you're really thinking about the need to reach out to the non-medical people who are the ones who respond to this. Teach us a bit about what happens to the body when you drown. I think most people understand that water in the lungs isn't good.
Okay, it depends on the age. So let's start with the little one. The kids, who is playing around the pool, and suddenly drops at the pool, usually don't have any time to ask for help or cry or any sound at all. So it's something that happens suddenly without notice anyone. They sink, usually immediately, hold their breath. Because they know that they can't breathe underwater, but in a few seconds they lost their consciousness, and the heart is still beating. So when the father or the mother or the relative gets these children from below water or underwater, the first most important procedures will be to look for the breath and start to breathing for the children. And the most significant procedure will be to give 5 ventilation for this children who is drowning.
Well, you mentioned about children, and I remember years ago when I was swimming in a lake with my brother-in-law, and he was out swimming, was going to swim across a lake, and maybe it was a half mile. And I remember him getting halfway across, and all of a sudden I realized he was really struggling. And so we went out with a boat, and I jumped out, and it wasn't very long before I realized that I was struggling too. And I guess I was struck, is there a difference in adults and drowning that I didn't think that I might drown, but I think both of us came closer than we would have liked to have thought.
Yeah, now, in adults, it's a little, it's a process that is a little more slowly, but it's fast too. I mean, what happened is that usually on a beach scenario, the male doesn't call for help, doesn't yell for help.
That's me.
That sounds like Adam.
That sounds okay. Like me, yes.
Yeah, no. If there's many people around, the man used to be ashamed to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And they only start to think that they need to ask for help when they are really tired, exhausted, and at that time he can raise their arm, his arm, to ask for help. So if he raised the arm, he sinks immediately. So when the male is drowning, they usually sink immediately. I'm not sure if I make myself clear.
Yes, I think the male needs to get help quicker, because by the time they ask, they're too
sick. That's it. That's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Spielman, we do need to take a break, and then we'll come back and really would love to talk more about the guidelines that you say and put in your article to prevent drowning. We'll return in just a moment, continue talking with our guest, Dr. David Spielman, about preventing deaths from drowning. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with drowning expert Dr. David Spielman about preventing deaths from drowning. And Dr. Spielman, you put in your article some very practical and very wise tips and guidelines for the prevention of drowning. As you say, it's the non-physicians, it's the non-medical people who are the ones responding to this. So we need to teach our listeners, and we're hoping you'll teach us what to do to prevent drowning. Let's start with strategies to keep yourself safe. What do you recommend to people for preventing drowning and keeping themselves safe?
Okay, we really need to split this information in three different things.
Okay,
first would be the beaches, which. We have to follow everyone has to follow the signs of lifeguards, of warnings, at which lifeguard use at the beach. Never swim in areas without lifeguards. Know the weather and the water condition before going in the water. Always swim with somebody else. Never go in the water after drinking alcohol or eating a lot.
Dr. Spielman, I just want to ask you a question about what you said, always swim with others. And one of the things that I've seen and read about recently is people drowning together, or someone's drowning and someone goes out to try to save them and then they both drown. Help me understand. It does seem intuitive that if there are two people there, one person can help. But what do they need to be able to do to help and prevent themselves from drowning at the same time?
Yeah, what happened is we always advice that if you're not a swimmer, or if you're not have confidence to help someone in the water, you can help outside the water, asking for a lifeguard or asking for throwing some floating, or asking, calling someone to help. But it, you're right, Adam. One of the problems when we at the beach see someone drowning is never get inside to help if you're not confident to do that.
Could you take your shirt off and throw your, and while holding one end of the shirt, let them hold it so you don't get too close? Because I do know when I was trying to rescue my relative, yeah, that they wanted to push me down, and I that's what was difficult, yeah, versus if maybe if they were holding on to something, maybe I could pull them. I don't really know.
Yeah, now we always advise to have some floating with you, a pet, like a soda pet, or a surfboard, or a ball, or something that you can throw to the victim, and they have these things that can float and can help yourself to be avoiding you to be dragged and avoiding you to be grabbed by the victim and drowning together with the victim. So we advise always not to get too much in contact with the victim, because it's very, very dangerous. And it's very usual that someone goes to help somebody and drown together.
Well, I'm also struck, you talk about the importance of learning to swim and learning water safety survival skills. It seems logical that, you know, you're less likely to drown if you know how to swim. I'm surprised at how many parents that I encounter or adult patients never learn to swim. And I wonder how that poses an additional challenge to supervise your children and watch them and try to teach them to swim, to help someone if you yourself don't have confidence in the water.
Yeah. It's a something that's a family thing, yeah. Yeah, if you want to that your children know how to swim, you have to get in the water and try to stimulate them to see what you are doing, like any other action that parents do.
And if parents are going to be supervising children, they should probably learn to swim, if possible, to increase the chance that they could help save their child if needed.
Yeah, but that's something interesting, because for when we are talking about drowning among little kids, the drowning almost always occur around the water, or around the house, or in the house at the pool, and it's usually not deep. Usually is a meter or a meter and a half deep. Mm. So parents and relatives always can help standing up at the place. So this is the usually thing that happens in little kids.
Interesting.
Let me ask you a question. When many parents are perhaps at a pool that doesn't have a lifeguard, and if a bunch of families were getting together, should they appoint someone to be a lifeguard if there are lots of small children around? Because I would worry that you might not notice, if there's not a lifeguard, that a child has been underwater for a couple minutes.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent idea. I'm not sure if you can contract a lifeguard to to work for you for a day, but this will be excellent, because It will release parents and people and adults to take their join a party without many worries about their children. Would be spectacular, but I'm not sure if it's suitable.
Thinking about other strategies to prevent drowning, Do certain countries have laws either requiring people to learn to swim or requiring a lifeguard. Are there laws that can be put into place to save lives?
Yeah, the thing is, we have many strategies to prevent drowning. One of those is to teach little kids how to swim. This is not this is something that prevents drowning in a water, in a calm water,
mm-hmm.
not at the beach or at the river, for example. At the river, for example, there is some different dangers that there is a hole at the river. There's a very strong current usually, and this is, it needs to different strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm intending to say is that you really need to focus where is happened you're drowning. For example, if you are a mother, you have to focus at your children at home. That's usually where happens. If you are a mother and have teenagers, you have to take, and you are close to the beach, you have to take care at the preventive actions at the beach, and they are different.
Yeah, I know we've seen a number of drownings at a particular lake around our community in which it's hypothesized that the bottom of the lake is very soft, and when people go in,
it
gives way. And so to me, this is that we should focus on that lake and require something very different, whether it's a regulation or education.
Yeah, one of those that works very well at the lake is to avoid people going wherever they want, and start to indicate them to some specific places where you can put lifeguards, where you can put safe, where you can put, when you can inform them by what the danger is supposed to have there, and this is avoid many drowning.
Well, Dr. Spielman, we do need to wrap up, but we really appreciate the time that you have taken to teach us about drowning and preventing drowning for our families and loved ones. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all. And I hope we can give you some tips that save many people.
Yes, and we will put a link to your article in the New England Journal of Medicine on our website, and thank you again. We appreciate all of your efforts.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns.
We got some wonderful house calls today, Christy, about exercise and cramping.
About fuzzy vision and numbness that went away.
Sounds scary, though, but about a young person also that's kind of scary who had heart palpitations, and their doctor said it was supraventricular tachycardia.
And also about guidelines about getting blood transfusions. So let's jump right in with our first house call.
I am 52 years old, and I run frequently. Occasionally, I get cramping in my foot and in my hand after running. It goes away with time, but it worries me a little. Seems more noticeable this summer. Any thoughts or suggestions?
This could almost be me, Christy. I'm 52. I run frequently. I don't get the cramping in my foot and my hand necessarily all the time. But, you know, you get, when you're running, you get aches and pains, and, you know, you can get some numbness and tingling sometimes.
Well, I'll say to our listener and to you, good for you for running frequently. And getting those cramps can be really bothersome. And I see that it sounds like it scares you just enough to ask about it. More noticeable in the summer makes me think of things like, are you drinking plenty of fluids, keeping up with either Gatorade or water or something?
It's awfully hot outside, too.
It's so hot.
And I know sometimes runners, actually, when they're running, their arms are kind of not necessarily at a neutral position or down low, mm-hmm. but they're up high and they're bent. So you actually, with cramping in the arms, I could see that you might be actually cutting off some circulation while you're running there. So, you know, I'd encourage you to run with your arms in a more neutral position. I don't know about cramping in the feet so much, but I like your idea of staying hydrated and also stretching.
Yeah, stretching, staying hydrated, trying to run in relaxed positions, taking breaks.
Walking.
If those things don't work, then certainly go see your doctor.
Or sports medicine specialist, even.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Christy.
My 80-year-old father recently had fuzzy vision for 20 seconds and numbness in both of his arms. It went away completely, and he feels fine now. He is not weak, and he can walk fine. Is this something worrisome for a stroke or something else?
Now, that is really scary, and it is worrisome for a stroke or one of those mini strokes called a TIA.
Transient ischemic attack. I like those words. Transient meaning it doesn't really last. Ischemic meaning it's dangerous. And attack meaning, boy, better do something about it.
It does sound worrisome to me that there was some blockage of blood flow to some part of the brain that caused the numbness and caused that fuzzy vision for a little period of time, and then it went away. And the good news is that it went away, but the bad news is that that could mean that your loved one, your father, is at higher risk of having a bad stroke.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where all reasonable doctors would probably agree this needs to be looked at. This person, your loved one's going to, father's going to need to probably have imaging done of their brain, potentially imaging of their heart, look at whether or not they're on aspirin or a medicine called Plavix. There needs to be some work up here, and it needs to be in a safe environment. So we would definitely encourage this to be worked up.
Or if your father really doesn't want to go through all that, they could have a conversation about not working it up. But maybe if he's not on an aspirin, taking an aspirin now. But that conversation should be had.
Quickly.
Let's take our next house call question.
I am a young person who has heart palpitations and what my doctors say is SVT. I take medication now and it is controlled. I wonder, though, if I should see a cardiologist to have what I read about is a procedure or permanently cure the SVT.
SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, fast heart. That's basically what it means, but it's kind of an abnormal fast heart.
You know, the fact that you're young, I think, really, really plays a role in this because taking those medications for a long time can be really burdensome and can have side effects. And also, presumably, you have a young heart. And so maybe there's just one little part of your circuit that's firing off this funny rhythm that could be treated through a procedure called ablation. I'm not saying that for sure, but it's possible. So I think looking into it and talking to a heart specialist is a good idea. What do you think, Adam?
Well, we're going to assume that your good doctors have already looked at thyroid conditions and that alcohol is not involved. Some of the other conditions that can get us worried here, but let's assume that that's been done. I agree. And actually, your primary care physician could work with your cardiologist to make a referral, because actually there's even a specialty of the cardiologist. It's not your
right.
general cardiologist. It's your EP, your electrophysiologist, matter of fact, if you ask them about regular cardiology, they'll probably say, no, you have to go to see a regular cardiologist. So that's a line, but you could work with that. And I agree, Christy.
I think it's worth the consult. Well, I mean, the worst they could say is no.
Yep.
Put you in the same situation you are now.
Yeah, we wouldn't say no, though.
Wish you the best.
Let's listen to our very last house call.
I have heard that new guidelines exist over when or whether someone needs to get blood when they have anemia. My aunt has low blood count, was feeling very tired and a little dizzy. Should she get a blood transfusion?
Well, that's a tough question for us to answer. Without more information, I would love to know what the blood count was and what the thoughts are about why your aunt is anemic or having low blood counts. Um, but But my general feeling is that if there are symptoms and she's feeling tired and dizzy, and if that seems to be linked with the blood count being low, that a transfusion is reasonable.
Yeah. What you may be referring to was in the news a number of months ago where they talked about, we used to say if your blood hemoglobin was less than 8, we would kind of, even if you didn't have any serious underlying conditions, people would consider doing transfusions. But there really wasn't any evidence that that actually really benefited people. But doctors got kind of nervous because you're kind of half your blood volume's down. And I think what they discovered was there really wasn't any benefit from those who, there was a study where they half got those transfusions and half didn't, and there was really no long-term benefit in the absence of symptoms. In this case, it sounds like there could be some symptoms, so we'd want to know more.
And most people would follow, if that hemoglobin is less than 7, transfusion is probably going to be beneficial. And if it's above 7, but you have some symptoms like dizzy, fatigue, those types of things, then having the transfusion may be beneficial. And certainly if you are, no matter what your hemoglobin is, really, if you're actively losing blood in the hospital or something, then the transfusion may happen well before that.
Well, Christy, that will conclude our house calls, but we've had a chance to not only talk about this anemia and symptoms, but also about supraventricular tachycardia and possibly ablation or getting rid of the disturbance.
About symptoms that sound concerning to us for a TIA or a mini stroke.
And finally, about cramping and running in the heat and maybe ways of preventing it. We wish you luck, and we want to thank all of our listeners who sent in and gave us great questions this week.
We want those of you out there to send us your stories and your questions. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. You can find our new health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. David Spillman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.